The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
The thing I've learned most, and I would say the biggest lesson from trial that I've learned, is that by far the critical thing is who's on that jury.
Steve Padgett shares the lessons he's learned in the courtroom, and one of his three most important things in life, ethics.
I think if you have to worry about ethics, you've got a problem. And it's when you start trying to see how close you can get to the line, that's when people start really worrying about whether they're being ethical or not.
And his loss of the Florida governor's race.
I felt really bad when we didn't win. I was probably too liberal for that situation, but you know, I was able to get elected up here in Jacksonville, so I thought I'd be okay for the state. But I'm probably too liberal.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. On today's program, something different. We feature someone who is as well known for his political life as his distinguished trial career. Steve Padgett served Jacksonville in the Florida House of Representatives for 6 terms in the 1970s and 80s. Nominated by the St. Petersburg Times as the most valuable House member 7 years in a row. As a lawmaker, he shepherded expansion of the property tax homestead exemption from $5,000 to $25,000. In 1986, he was the Democratic nominee for governor of Florida, losing to Bob Martinez in a tight race. A self-described Florida cracker, Steve Padgett is half of the original Padgett and Padgett law firm. His brother Gary passed away in 2006, but the practice remains a family firm with Steve's son and Gary's 3 sons. Together, the Padgett family has been a tremendous force in philanthropy and social equality. Steve Padgett, now in his 70s, sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in December 2017 to share how he's remained politically active, his resilient idealism, and his personal brand of civil justice.
Steve, you've led what appears to be a fascinating life, combining law, politics, and you're a big philanthropist as well.
I've had a lucky life. I remember one time when I was running for governor, and it was I'd made it past the runoff and then had the Democratic nomination, which was tantamount victory in the past for people like coming like me, and it wasn't going to be in my case. And we kind of knew it, and I was riding with a young reporter from Fort Lauderdale on the airplane coming back to Jacksonville a few days before the campaign. She says, "Well, what are you going to do next if you lose?" I said, "It looks like I'm probably going to lose." She said, "What are you going to do next?" And I said, "Well, I'm a white man who's had a good education and who's willing to work, and so it's going to be easy for me because I was lucky to have been born with great parents, with, you know, as I said, to be a white man who was given plenty of educational opportunity. And so it's been a good life, but it's been a very good life for me, but I don't take too much credit for it. I think I've just been fortunate. And there are a lot of people who work just as hard and probably have just as much or more ability who haven't been so fortunate.
Well, you grew up very poor, though.
Well, my father was his family were immigrants. When he went to the first grade, he couldn't speak a word of English. and he only went through the fourth grade. He was a carpenter. But on my mother's side, she had a college education. And she didn't work, though. She stayed home and raised us six kids at home. And so, yes, we didn't have a whole lot of money, but we had a very loving, nurturing family where education was valued.
Well, let's start with the law. What made you want to be a lawyer?
Well, this is an interesting story, I think, because my brother and I were only 14 months apart, and we were very close. We grew up, we used to sleep in the same bed with one or two of my sisters, but then we got our own, Daddy made us our own little bedroom in that little cracker house we had, and because he added on a little bit to it. And then we slept in the same bed together till I went off to college. But we were very close, my brother Gary and I. And we decided that when we got out of college that we wanted to do something together. And the reason we chose law was because you didn't have to have any money to get into it. And so we said this would be a nice little business for us, a nice thing for us to do. And we could come back to Jacksonville, our hometown, and have our own little practice together. And it worked out really well for us.
Boy, and what an education you got. Princeton University, Phi Beta Kappa, and then went on to Harvard Law School, graduating with honors there.
Yeah, you know, then my brother, he could have also gone to Princeton, but he decided to go to Florida State, played football over there, and then he went to Florida State Law School. And I would say that in the courtroom, in the law practice, you really couldn't tell the difference. Now, not to say that I didn't get a good education and that I'm not very grateful for it. And I think it's especially added to my appreciation of life in general. But you can be a Florida, you can be a Seminole, which I am in sports for sure, and still do just as well.
And despite Gary's passing, your firm is very much a family firm. Your son is an attorney there. You've got three nephews.
Three of Gary's boys, Curry, Kurt, and Seth, and then my son, Michael. And everybody gets along great, and we have lots of long-term employees. And it's a nice place to be and to go and to work.
What were the most important influences in your life growing up? What lessons did you learn that prepared you for law or that have guided you throughout your law career?
Well, it's interesting because I'm not, I would say first my family, but I would say I'm not really a religious person. But I grew up going to a Southern Baptist church five times on Sunday. We went to Sunday school, Sunday morning service, then we had afternoon choir practice, then we had training union, then we had Sunday evening service. And sometimes we'd go during the week as well to Royal Ambassadors or to sometimes a prayer meeting on Wednesday night. And I can sing and do sing all the time, a thousand hymns and gospel songs, and love to sing them. And somewhat of a student of the Bible as well. But so the church was, even though I'm not religious now, the church was an influence in instilling certain values in us about the values of caring for the downtrodden and for trying to make something good out of your life. I would say even more important was my family, and lucky to have good education, good teachers all the way along too.
And of course, your brother right there by your side.
Yes, all the time. And we even had park directors. We were both called park rats because if we weren't at school, we were more often than not at the park, barefooted in a pair of jeans, no shirt, no cap, and playing all the sports.
In law, early in your career, did you have a mentor?
When I was going to start out the practice, my wife and I, after we got out, I got out of law school, we did one of the best things we ever did, which was that we sold everything we had, which wasn't much, took a little bit of money that we'd inherited from when her mother died, $2,500. We bought charter flight tickets to Europe, and leaving in June and coming back in early October. We made a down payment on MGB convertible that we picked up in London that we still have, 1971 MGB. Wow. And we traveled around Europe on for 3.5 months on $5, Europe on $5 a day, and had a wonderful time. When I got back to Jacksonville, we moved in with my parents in that house on the west side with no air conditioning, an old cracker house that I had grown up in. And I took the bus down to go to work and got there. And the lawyer, former judge, who had offered me the job before, said he was sorry to say, but he didn't really have the authority to do what he had done. And I didn't have a job. So I had to take the bus back home, tell my wife we weren't quite ready. The car hadn't been shipped back from Europe yet. And we were stuck there in our house on the west side. And I interviewed around with three different firms. Was fortunate to end up with a really nice, good young firm with some good young lawyers in there. It was Mahoney, Hadlow, Chambers, and Adams. All of those named partners were influential to me and helpful to me, plus some others, like Charlie Commander. But I stayed there only 3 years, because then when I ran for and got elected to the legislature, with their blessing, and then Gary and I started our own practice. And we had to learn a lot then by doing it and doing it carefully and observing others.
What made you get into politics?
It was part of that idea that wanting to do something worthwhile with your life, to have some public service as a part of what you're doing with your life, and I was fully supported in that by my brother and by my wife and my whole family. But in fact, I used to say if it had been Gary instead of me, then he would have gotten elected governor, because he was the nicer guy and the better politician, really.
How did you go about honing your trial skills?
Well, I went with Mahoney Hadlow. My brother went with the state attorney's office and got an award after being there for only 2 years from the police association in Jacksonville he had prosecuted someone they'd really been after for a long time. Esten Bullard was his name, and he became a very accomplished trial lawyer. When we started out our practice together, we did anything that came in the door, and I had really never tried a case, so I learned from him, really.
Okay.
He was my younger brother, but a great teacher in that. But I would say, you know, being a good lawyer is really not that different than being good at anything. You just work hard, you try to be personable, you care for the people that you're working with. So I'm not one who really would emphasize that all these lawyerly skills that someone has to pick up. I don't think you have to pick up great lawyerly skills to get great results for your client, and to be able to communicate with a jury, even more important than communicating with a jury is being able to figure out who should be on the jury and who should not. That's something that we've spent a lot of time developing within our firm, and I'm proud of our ability to do that.
And you're very heavily involved in that part.
Yes. Yeah, we have our own proprietary algorithm, computerized algorithm that we use in jury selection. It doesn't take the subjectivity out of it, but it makes it, it organizes it, and it's been very successful for us.
And you've been a very successful plaintiff's attorney. What's the most rewarding part about being a plaintiff's attorney?
Absolutely no question about that. The most rewarding part is when you have clients who have really suffered a tragedy, catastrophic tragedy, who then you get them some financial relief. You also get them some emotional relief, a sense of catharsis, and a sense of justice that you can achieve for them, and it can really make a difference in their lives, particularly people who have if they've had a catastrophic injury, and then it's not just that they now can take care of themselves, but they converts them from being a burden, what they feel like. They're not the person they used to be. They're now a burden to the family. And when they have enough resources and they get this affirmation of a good verdict or a good settlement, then they are changed from being a burden to people in their mind to someone who actually now has the resources to help others and that people want to be around and that they can contribute to other people. And that really is such a nice feeling.
As an attorney, how helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
That's an interesting question. Because to me, it's kind of natural that you're always thinking about things. When I was in the legislature, I used to always say I'd get my best ideas riding in that car ride from Jacksonville to Tallahassee, about a two-hour ride, and sometimes I get my best ideas about a trial just in the shower. And I also like riding my bike to and from work, which I do when we're in town every day, or going out kayaking and fishing. But I don't think of those things myself as self-reflection. Those really, I'm thinking about other things, people, ideas, situations. And I'm probably not very good at self-reflection myself. It's just not part of my makeup to think about whether, about where I am and what I'm doing. I just think about the situation around me and how I'm going to deal with it and how I respond to it and how I can contribute to it.
This is a very tough profession, and especially with the competition these days. Looking back through today, what are the secrets of your day-to-day success?
Well, I should have said this earlier, that my brother and I, we had a little thing that we would say, but there are only three important things in life. We use it like when we're coaching teams. We'd say to the little kids that we're coaching, we'd say, well, the three important things are you're going to, number one, be a good sport. Number two, you're going to play hard for your team. And number three, we're going to have fun. And then in the law practice, we'd say, number one, we're going to be ethical. Number two, we're going to do the best job we can for our clients. Number three, we're going to make it as enjoyable as we can. And we think then that what happens is the winning work takes care of itself. The making money or being successful takes care of itself. If long as you can think about first the values, second the hard work, and third, it is make it as enjoyable as we can, as much fun as we can for ourselves and for the people around us.
How do you handle disappointment?
Well, you know, I'm a big crier, but I don't cry over disappointments. I cry from a movie, a book, a story, or the disappointments. What happens to me on disappointments is I can remember just a few years back after Gary was gone, and it was one of his sons was trying it with me, and we had settled a couple parts of the case before we tried the case, and we tried the case, and we lost the case. And when I went back, and over that weekend, I wrote an email about the 10 things we did wrong, because it was a way of trying to reevaluate all this and mentor back to my nephew who was working on the trial with me. And that would say that that is my typical thing. It's not necessarily a good thing, but whenever something happens, I'll rework it in my mind. Just kind of naturally occurs until I've got it kind of figured out and analytically put together. And you learn from that. You learn a lot from it. The thing I've learned most, and I would say the biggest lesson from trial that I've learned, is that by far the critical thing is who's on that jury. And you got to do you start out with a story and you make the story the best you can. And you've got to continually do that. And you've got to present it in the most interesting way you can. But given a basic set of facts or basic situation that you've got to deal with, the jury is the most important thing.
Let's talk about some of those stories. Is there one particular case so far that you'll never forget? Maybe the most significant, most notable?
I got lots of cases that I would never forget. One, it was maybe our first trial after my after I got out of politics, and it was a hit and run by a logging truck in one of the rural counties around here, and it left our client about in the middle of the roadway in the pre-dawn hours, paralyzed, and the from the waist down. He had been on his motorcycle, and the log truck had pulled out in front of him, and then continued on. So a doctor referred the case to us, a doctor whom we had sued over a, not him, but the anesthesiologist for, and he was the surgeon, when there had been a mistake in anesthesiology, he referred the case to us. But in that case, there were so many kind of little stories and interesting things that came out of that case, and it was like going back in time, the trial too, because it was in an old courthouse, and the jury would come in, and the people in the town would come in. They'd be knitting in the courtroom. The witnesses, after they testified, would not leave. They would hang around. The defense attorney referred to my client in final argument before the jury as that boy, because he was an African American. And the trial went on for some time. So that trial stands out in my mind, as do some others too I could talk about. But you know, it's all. Each trial becomes kind of a story unto itself. You know, there's a story about what happened, but then the trial itself becomes a story, because you get so wrapped up in it for a couple of weeks, and you get such intimate, close connections with your client, with the witnesses, with the opposing counsel, with the judge, the jury, interesting and unforgettable experience when you get into trials that are like that. Before we could try the case, we had to find the truck. And to do that, had to go get some help from the local sheriff, had to get a deputy sheriff watching the trucks that happened to come by this particular location in the morning, had to get the list of the trucks through the sheriff from the mill that they were going to, of the trucks that were there early that morning. Then they had to go one night in the middle of the night to take a sample off of a tire rim of a truck before we identified it. And then when we went to go try the case, there was a potential eyewitness, the grand dame of this little town, whose the truck had been parked overnight in the front of what used to be their general store. And our investigator, best investigator around here, had been by to see her, and she couldn't remember what kind of trucks parked down there. So when we were fixing to go up and try the case again, I said, well, I'm going to try one more time. So I went to visit her myself, and I said, can't you remember? I mean, our investigator came by to see you, and she said, you know what? She said, after your investigator came by to see me, she said, it came to me in a dream that night. The name of that truck was, and then she spelled it out. And so I had her tell exactly that story to that jury, of course. And we won the verdict in the case where the insurance company had offered no money and was denying all liability. And courts had picked up the excess, of course, later on over and above the insurance.
Wow. Steve, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that my brother was, we kind of divided things up as we came along. And my brother Gary, he took the professional relations and was more intimately involved and enjoyed it very much. And when I first came in contact with the people in the Florida Justice Association was when I was in politics, when I was running for governor. And I had such tremendous support from the group. And I felt really bad when we didn't win. I was probably too liberal for that situation, but you know, I was able to get elected up here in Jacksonville, so I thought I'd be okay for the state. But probably too liberal. But we ran well, but didn't end up losing. But that had good support from the people in the Florida Justice Association. And then over the years, I've kind of kept up that contact with people who are some of the best people in the state, you know. And we've worked together to support other political candidates. Because the Florida Justice Association and trial lawyers in general are the strongest interest group to support the average consumer, the average citizen out there, against these powerful business interests. And I think the Justice Association plays an extremely critical role in this regard. And I've enjoyed my times working with the people in the Florida Justice Association and my friends there to do the best we can to get good people elected, including we were very proud of our involvement in the election of President Obama, and had a lot of good people here in the state work on that too. And I think we did. Unfortunately, we're living through a different kind of time right now, but we'll make it through it, and we'll keep working for the best people, and it'll pay dividends to the voters and to the consumers of the state.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have any concerns?
One thing that people don't appreciate enough, I think, about what the role that lawyers actually play in the American society. I mean, it is appreciated the role they play in helping legislation. There are a lot of lawyers who are legislators or congressmen. And of course, lawyers have got to argue before the courts all the time. But trial lawyers, plaintiff's trial lawyers, also play a critical role. We play a critical role in making sure that businesses are held accountable for safety concerns and for what the impact their activities might have on other people. And that's really a part of our economic system. That's if they don't take into account that cost, the cost that of what the, when somebody gets hurt or somebody gets killed or some property gets destroyed, it'll be a much worse place to live, America would be. And now you could do it another way. You could say, well, we're going to do it through just regulation, and we're going to have strong enough regulations that make sure that everything is, safety is entirely taken care of. And we could take care of people who are hurt another way. We would say we're going to have such good welfare and health insurance that people are taken care of that way. And some of the European countries do a better job in these areas than we do. In America, that role has fallen to lawyers, to plaintiff's trial lawyers, to taking care of safety concerns for consumers, to making sure that businesses are held accountable. At the same time that we have the government under President Trump, reducing regulations in every way they can, that makes it even more important for trial lawyers to step up and make sure that things are done right in America, so that the average person is not forgotten, so the environment is not polluted.
I hear your passion.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, Mike Papantonio said, yeah, it used to be you could rely on government to do some of these things, but you can't. Toward your end, you need trial lawyers to hold corporations accountable.
Right. And I would say,
it's the last defense, I think, is how you put it.
Yes, I'd say that in America, we never have really relied upon government to take care of that role that trial lawyers have to fulfill. Now, it's true that in some European countries we have, but not in America. And cars in America really only became safe when the companies knew that if they didn't make them safe, they were going to have to pay for it in the courtroom. And it's that way in a lot of other areas, too. I don't think it's that lawyers are having to step into a void that is being created now in America. I think it's a role and a function that lawyers, trial lawyers, have always performed, at least in my lifetime. in this American society.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk about ethics, because that's one of your three keys to success there. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
Never. And I'll say this about ethics, too. I think if you have to worry about ethics, you've got a problem. I think, really, I've never really believed in the necessity for courses on ethics myself, or for people say, well, what, try to figure out what is the ethical course of behavior here. Because doing the, really the fair and right thing and the just thing to do and the honest thing to do is usually pretty obvious. And it's when you start trying to see how close you can get to the line, that's when people start really worrying about whether they're being ethical or not. As long as you're always saying, well, I'm going to do the fair, the right, the just, the honest thing, you're not going to have to worry about ethics. But that doesn't mean that you're not concerned about ethics. It means that ethics are so important that you're not going to have to worry about them.
What one piece of advice would you have for incoming lawyers?
To care about your clients and doing the best job you can for your clients. And your clients can feel that and know that. Judges can feel that and know it. Opposing counsel can feel it and know it. And when you care and when you do a good job for them, they're going to send their friends to you. My brother and I, did we lose cases over the years? Yes, we lost trials. And we lost some that we felt bad about. But when those cases, when we had clients where we lost a trial, those clients were still referring us new cases all along the way, because they knew that we did the very best job for them that we can and that we could and that we cared about them.
Steve, how would you like to be remembered?
You know, I don't really worry about that, truthfully. I think, you know, when I'm gone, you know, my brother's gone now, my sister-in-law's gone, when I'm gone, I don't really care about how people remember me. I do care a little bit about what kind of impact I had on their lives, and I would like to see, and I expect and know that, like, with the people that have been close to me and that I've worked with, that they will contribute to society. They will do the right thing. They will be making my son, my nephews, they will be making a positive impact on life around here. The best way I can be remembered is to leave behind me people that I've worked with who will continue to make a positive impact on our life here.
And we need to talk about your philanthropy. You have given so much money over the years and lent your personal support, $2 million to Edward Waters College. You still give back to your old elementary school, Annie R. Morgan, here in Jacksonville. You have a $1 million scholarship program set up with your high school alma mater, Paxson High School, to send deserving students to the University of North Florida. How important has that been to you to give back?
Well, here's the way I think about most of the philanthropy that my wife and I, my brother and I, that we've done over the years. It's a shame that we have to do it. And it's really a drop in the bucket, because most of the things that we're trying to do are things really that government should do, to provide educational opportunity to people who didn't have the same parents that we had, didn't have the same opportunity we had. Those are things really that the government should do. And what we've been able to do is really just very much on the margin, I want to do it, but at the same time, I also want to do what I can to make government do a better job of providing education, of taking care of the disadvantaged, of protecting our environment, because that's really where the task should begin. But when they don't, there's so much left undone that to the extent that we can, we try to help out.
Steve Padgett, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org, or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.